This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy. Radio station, Joy 94.9.
This is Michael and Peter Spierig.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hi, my name is Madeline Olmec. I'm the director of the Foxy Merkins, and you're listening to Joy 94.9.
Hi, I'm Sarah Lamberg. You might know me as a lesbian cannibal, or sometimes a delusional life-drawing model, or perhaps a neurotic people pleaser. That's right, I'm an actor and director, and this is Sci-Fi and Scream.
This is Matthew A. Brown, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on 94.9.
Hi, this is Erin Gray from Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hey, everybody, this is Cristal Alonso, and I am boldly going where no man has gone before. Or maybe they have. I don't know what kind of life you live. You're listening to Joy 94.9.
You're very humble.
just anxious. It seems to me as though some of the strongest expressions of what's happening and the strongest revelations of what's happening have actually come through comics. It's been amazing. I was always drawing my own comics too. In a way, it feels to me like comics were my first storytelling language. So it's like my native tongue for storytelling is comics. It's the one I feel most comfortable with and familiar with. You know, when, it doesn't matter what you're doing, whether it's music or writing or comics or painting. I think if you're trying to work in the arts, you have to embrace the fact that that making an income from it is kind of a bonus.
And
what you're trying to do is you're just trying to produce a whole lot of work, that means something to you and that you enjoy creating, and that's the priority.
This is Sonia for Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9, and I'm here at the Home Cooked Comics Festival for 2015 in Northcote. It is Anzac Day. As it turns out, it's on a Saturday. It's just a coincidence. And here we are, two Anzacs here without the biscuit. I'm with Dylan Horrocks, and I want to welcome you to the show, Dylan.
Thank you.
But yes, Dylan, what a career that spans a few decades now of your work, cartoons, comics, graphics, and certainly it is amazing for you to be in Melbourne for this venture today. How are you going today, being here at Home Cooked?
It's great. It's a wonderful festival. It's kind of small and intimate, but really interesting. And then tomorrow will be the market day, so all sorts of people will be coming and buying comics, and there'll be more talks. It's the second time I've been to Melbourne. I came some years ago for a little festival at the Wheeler Centre, and also ran a workshop for a week. So I got to know the local comic scene a little bit then, and was enormously impressed. And so it's wonderful to be back and see some old friends and discover new people doing stuff. Yeah, it's just, Melbourne just seems to have such an interesting comic scene.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty diverse too. And we've had the Ledgers on the 10th of April. We had that, which acknowledges the contribution that artists and writers for comics make. Yeah, it's good to see that happen. And now so many other festivals and things like the Home Cooked. But for you, let's dig into that career a little bit. This is probably the first time some of our listeners have perhaps heard of you, which is appalling. They should know who you are, and they will now. They've got no excuse in this very special podcast. But your career goes back to the days of Auckland Uni, I think, wasn't it? Crackham, and maybe more, and of course Hicksville, and more recently the Magic Pen, and many, many, many things. But let's look right back to those early uni days.
Actually, when I was at university, mm-hmm. I discovered a comic published from Melbourne called Fox Comics,
okay.
which was edited by Dave Oddicker and Phil Bentley, and it was really a very interesting comics magazine. It had contributions by a range of Australian cartoonists, mm-hmm. also some of my some British cartoonists who were a revelation to me as well. Amazing magazine. So I started sending them stuff, and they started publishing it. So my first overseas published comics were published here in Melbourne as well. I guess, I mean, I was just obsessed with comics from the very beginning, and I was reading comics. My dad was into comics, so our house always had a good range of stuff there. And I grew up reading Tintin and Asterix and Peanuts and so on, but also some quite obscure stuff. He had collections of old 1940s Captain Marvel comics by C.C. Beck, and occasionally European stuff apart from Tintin and Asterix too. He once brought home a copy of Pilot magazine from the 70s, which was a French comics. Pilot. P-I-L-O-T-E. And actually that particular issue that he brought home had the first comic by a cartoonist called Jean Giraud, in which he explored a new style that became Moebius, who was one of the most influential cartoonists of the... Yeah. He introduced me to all kinds of things, and underground comics too, like Robert Crumb and Gilbert Shelton. So I grew up reading it, and I was always drawing my own comics too. In a way, it feels to me like comics were my first storytelling language. So it's like my native tongue for storytelling is comics. It's the one I feel most comfortable with and familiar with. And so right through school, I was drawing my own comics and gradually started just putting them out as photocopied mini comics. Mm-hmm. And at university, I did stuff for the student newspaper, and a friend of mine started a new comics magazine called Razor, where I think we managed to get a grant from the student union, you know, and that covered some of the printing. But then we just kept it going. It was one of those things, we never made any money, but we got a lot of comics in print. I started sending stuff to Fox, and I felt a bit like, you know, wow, I'm being published overseas, I've hit the big time. Any minute now, I'll be a millionaire. But of course, you know, it's small press stuff. I think by the time I started kind of doing it professionally, I guess, I'd probably drawn hundreds and hundreds of pages of comics by then, and I'd put quite a lot of them out in print. So I never really made a big distinction between the professional work and the non-professional work, because to me it was all the same work, and it all just kind of work. It's just occasionally someone would pay me for it, you know. Yeah. So it's hard to sort of say when it turned into a career. It's just at a certain point I quit the day job. Actually, I quit the day job when we had a 6-month-old baby, and it was my wife who said, she said, you know, you're working all day in a bookshop, and then you're coming home and drawing your comics, and it's exhausting. And it's hard for you to do both. I don't think you should keep this up. And I thought, oh boy, you know, is this the time when I have to decide whether I give up comics? And she said, no, don't be stupid. You should quit the day job and make the comics work. And I thought she was insane, absolutely crazy. But it worked. You know, I got a weekly strip with a New Zealand magazine, and that just saved us from financial disaster.
Usually it's the other way around. You have the baby, you've got the commitments and the family, and you have to be into the real world. But how awesome that... You know, you had a different experience.
Well, it's my wife who's braver than I am. She's the one who's, you know, been a couple of times when I thought, God, this is crazy. You know, it's so hard to be a freelancer. And she'd say, no, you're doing it. It's all right. You're doing okay. Yeah.
And are you doing okay today? I mean,
I mean, I've done all kinds of things over the years. For a while, I was writing comics for DC Comics in America. So I wrote Batgirl for a while, and I did a Vertigo series called Hunter, the Age of Magic. You know, that was real money. that sort of helped us climb out of the financial hole that you dig when you're freelancing for a long time. And I've now got 3 books out of my own, which have done quite well. You know, it's fine. So I think, you know, it doesn't matter what you're doing, whether it's music or writing or comics or painting. I think if you're trying to work in the arts, you have to embrace the fact that that making an income from it is kind of a bonus.
And
what you're trying to do is you're just trying to produce a whole lot of work, a whole lot of work that means something to you and that you enjoy creating. And that's the priority. And if you have to have a day job or if you can get by without a day job, that's not really the main issue. The main issue is, are you doing the work that you want to do and getting it done? And that's, you know, it's hard sometimes, but it's also incredibly pleasurable and satisfying to actually be doing the work.
Cool.
Yeah, a lot of my favourite cartoonists have day jobs. I just don't see it as a big distinction.
I think you've got to be a realist, and certainly that's what I've noticed just in the comics culture here. Yeah, people have their other lives too, you know. They integrate it with the thing that they're very passionate about, and then you have these festivals where they can actually just be that person that they are, really are. So it's good to have that sort of support. What's the scene like in New Zealand, for example, compared to here?
In New Zealand, the scene is big and it's growing and it's very active. You know, we never had an industry in my lifetime. We did actually have a comics industry in the 1940s. That was during the Second World War, when there was a lot of... It was very difficult to import anything. There were import controls, and and the logistics were hard anyway. So comics weren't being imported. And so a few people stepped up and filled that market gap by producing New Zealand-made comics, which did quite well. You know, there was a handful of people who earned an okay living and managed to run successful businesses doing local comics. That all dried up after the war when the import restrictions were eased and the New Zealand market was flooded with overseas comics again. So then we had nothing. You know, we just had a few people doing comics for student newspapers or Capping magazines. And then since the 1970s, we've started, people have started to produce. In the late 1970s, we had a guy called Colin Wilson, who was a young cartoonist, and he, with a group of other cartoonists, created a magazine called Strips. And again, you know, didn't make any money, but it was, they were getting their work out there. It was an opportunity to do their comics. And Colin then left New Zealand and went to England and worked for 2000 AD and then worked in the European industry. And he now lives in Melbourne. So it's another kind of Melbourne connection. There's a few really good New Zealand cartoonists who've ended up in Melbourne. Colin Wilson is one. And he's, you know, he's doing work for the European industry, the American industry. He's a big name in Europe. I've travelled with him in Europe and he gets big cues for his signings.
He gets mobbed.
He gets mobbed, yes. It's really great to see. And but we, there's also Tim Malloy. Tim Malloy, who's got a few books out with Milk Shadow, and he's an old New Zealander. I mean, I sort of knew him back in New Zealand. So there's all sorts of connections. It's the Anzac thing again. Matt Emery, who's not only drawing great comics, Gazumo, but he's also publishing all sorts of fantastic stuff.
He's a comicologist or an archaeologist.
Yeah, and he's unearthing a lot of forgotten old New Zealand and Australian comics, researching them, interviewing people, gathering an archive of stuff, and he's getting both old stuff back in print and also publishing new exciting comics from New Zealand and Australia. He's, Matt is one of the true kind of heroes of Australasian comics.
You hear that, Matt?
Yeah, we love you, Matt.
Because he does Paper Trail, he does a little segment on my show, so I just could not have him.
Yeah,
I had to have him.
Yeah, Matt's really, he's, you know, we sort of want him back in New Zealand. He's
he's back there all the time. He'll be back in a few weeks. He's,
yeah,
he hops around with Picatia Press, and I think he's doing a thing on Noel Cook, which is amazing, at Wellington Library, I think it is.
Yeah. There's a little festival in Wellington organised by the Wellington Central Library, and he's part of that, along with Tim Bollinger, who's a New Zealand cartoonist who's also done a lot of research into the history of New Zealand comics.
The Noel Cook story is very interesting. Very interesting from a New Zealand perspective.
Yeah, New Zealand's produced a lot of cartoonists who've made quite a big impact. But up until recently, the only way they could do that was by leaving New Zealand. So David Lowe, the political cartoonist.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Noel Cook, who came to Australia, and he had a big offer from an American newspaper syndicate in the early days to do a strip, and he turned it down because he didn't want to leave Australasia. But he could have been huge, you know, if he'd done that. But also Colin Wilson, Roger Langridge is another New Zealander who moved to England and has done great stuff. But I think in recent years it's become much easier for New Zealanders to actually stay in New Zealand and have their work published internationally.
So, I guess, social media, obviously the internet.
Yeah, the internet's made such a huge difference. I mean, when I was working for DC, I was living in New Zealand by the beach, you know, and it was, the whole thing was just done by email. And
who was the artist at that time when you were writing Batgirl?
When I worked with a few artists, but the one who was the one who I was most consistently working with was Rick Leonardi, who's a veteran and very good. You know, he was a joy to work with. And on my Vertigo book, I worked with Richard Case. Again, it was an absolute joy to work with. A lovely guy, hugely talented.
And that's the great thing. You can just sit down, do it on your computer at home, send it off.
Yeah, in fact, I was just writing the script, so that was even easier. But, you know, they'd send me PDFs of stuff to look at. And the thing is, my books, I did a comic book for years during the 90s called Pickle, and that was published in Canada. I did another series called Atlas, which was also published in Canada by Drawn & Quarterly. And Hicksville, my first graphic novel, was published, again, in Canada by Black Eye.
So what is it about the Canadian connection?
You know, I don't know what it is about Canada. Canada has a slightly similar relationship to the US that New Zealand does with Australia.
Yes.
You know, it's the little neighbour who... It's a little more laid back, Canada. I don't know. Canada feels very familiar to me. Whenever I visit North America, you know, I travel around America and there's all sorts of interesting things in the US. But when I cross the border into Canada, I find myself just kind of relaxing.
You can take it down a notch and don't have the gun thing.
They don't have the gun thing.
That's one thing.
But also it feels more familiar. It feels slightly more like New Zealand. And I guess it's that they were a British, you know, they remained part of the British Empire for longer, and it just has the same kind of, some of the same feeling of a post-colonial country which was shaped for a long time by British culture. I don't know. It's
colder too, and it's
colder.
It's a similar type of thing for New Zealand.
It has its own history of colonial crimes and things.
Yes, I know.
As we all do, there's post-colonial countries. But I think Canada had some treaties too, actually.
I think it had several.
There's a lot of connections between Canadian nations, Native nations, and Maori iwi structures. There's a lot of to and fro and sharing of ideas and... I guess because they see connections there. Yeah.
There's that similarity. But you've stayed in New Zealand.
I did. I moved to England for a few years. Yeah. When I was younger, I just assumed that was the only way you could do it, was that you had to go to...
And every Kiwi goes to England, don't they? It's like, and works in a bar or something.
Yeah, it's the big OE. The big OE. Yeah, and that's what I did. I went to London and I worked in a bookshop for a few years. It was a hell of a time to be working in a bookshop because it was the height of the Salman Rushdie Satanic Verses controversy. And the bookshop I worked in was one of the first ones where he started to make public appearances again. So we couldn't publicise them in advance. But first the police would turn up and they'd do a sweep, and then he would turn up and then we'd be and he'd have a little kind of impromptu signing or talk.
So how do people, I mean, this would have been just before, I guess, oh, this is definitely before Twitter. So how do people find out about Salman's here type of thing? Come and get your book.
Sometimes what we'd do is we'd have a signing with Martin Amis and very special guest.
So
he wouldn't announce who the special guest was, but people kind of, you know, people got used to it and they're like, oh, it's probably Salman Rushdie. Right. Certainly the staff did. I mean, we all thought, oh, it's probably, because they wouldn't even tell us until 5 minutes before. And then they'd give us the option of not being there if we didn't feel safe. But of course we all stayed. I mean, it was Salman Rushdie.
And you work in a bookstore. There's no way that you're not.
Yeah, yeah. And I was very proud of the fact that actually that bookstore really stood by him, even though there were, you know, there was the odd brick through the window and death threat and so on. But, you know, as it mattered. But it was complicated. I mean, people were arguing endlessly about whether he should be supported or whether it was whether he'd gone too far. But yeah, much like with the Charlie Hebdo shootings recently.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that question because I'm sitting here as we're talking and you have the badge on, a badge that says Je suis Charlie. So it's something that is very personal to yourself, and you know you have strong feelings about this issue.
I was in New Zealand, so I was on the other side of the world when it happened. But I knew Charlie Hebdo as a magazine, and I knew particularly Walensky's work. I was familiar with. Mm. And 2 weeks later, I was actually in France for a festival. I went to the Angoulême Comics Festival, and my book. I just had 3 books come out in France, so it was. It was a really strange time to be there.
It would have been very odd.
Yeah, and the Angoulême Festival really was completely shaped by it. The thing is that those cartoonists who were killed, most of them, they didn't just do editorial cartoons in Charlie Hebdo. They also did comic books. Some of them did animation. Kabu had a slot on a kids show for years where he drew on TV, and it was to encourage kids to draw. You know, those guys were big names in French comics, not just in political cartoons.
French art culture, and because I spoke to Thomas Campy, who's also here at the Home Cook Festival this weekend, a few weeks back in an interview, and he said it's very different in Europe. There is, it's equivalent of filmmakers in some respects. The respect and the acknowledgement as an artist and almost as a superstar in some ways. So yes, it's had a bigger effect that's more obvious in Europe and in France than I guess here.
Yeah, it's very hard to think of real analogies in the English-speaking world because it's such a different context there, the role that cartoonists play in the culture. And I guess I feel like a lot of the discussion that happened after the shootings in the English-speaking world, where people were agonizing about whether Charlie Hebdo was, you know, a racist hate speech and stuff. I mean, for one thing, it was clearly, you know, the conversation was taking place among people who really knew nothing about Charlie Hebdo. They'd seen a few cartoons that were taken out of context and shared online, and they didn't know at all the magazine. They didn't get the humor. They didn't get the politics either. And they would, you know, people would share a cartoon that was viciously satirizing the racism of the National Front in France. They would see that cartoon and they didn't see the irony. They didn't realize that it was satirizing a particular attitude. They thought it was expressing the attitude.
Yes.
But there was a whole series of cartoons that were completely, totally misinterpreted. And then there were people who, when it was pointed out to them that they were misinterpreting it and then the context changed everything, they became defensive and said, well, the context doesn't matter. You know, you should never draw these images, no matter the context. But the thing that got me about the whole discussion in the English-speaking world was it's as though we were discussing a hypothetical, abstract, academic, philosophical question about free speech and the limits of offence and so on. We weren't talking about the actual cartoonists or their body of work or what had happened, the fact that they were gunned down in a particular set of circumstances. So I felt like the reality, the actual human reality, and also the artistic reality was all kind of lost. And I think, I mean, I've become really interested in that aspect of it, and I've been researching for another project, researching cartoonists all over the world who have been, you know, jailed, beaten, attacked, threatened, prosecuted, or killed for their cartoons, for their drawing. And it's a very depressingly large number of cartoons.
Yes, I've heard. We do probably hear more about journalists, of course, being captured and taken and imprisoned and beaten and tortured and murdered and executed as such. But you don't actually hear so much of artists and cartoonists. So it is interesting that in one way that's been positive. I think it's opened that up more for people to understand and respect that, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so too. You know, right now there's a couple of cartoonists in Turkey who've been convicted
they
were convicted of disrespecting the president. You know, as if that should be a crime anywhere in the world.
It does remind me a little bit of Tom Scott. I think it's Tom Scott from the Muldoon era. You remember that bizarre relationship between the Prime Minister of New Zealand at the time and a cartoonist, and that hilarious conversation they had between each other that was very public.
Yeah,
but nobody got arrested.
No, well, Muldoon basically kicked Tom Scott out of the parliamentary press conferences.
Yeah.
Because he didn't like what he'd been writing and drawing in his cartoons. But, of course, Tom Scott is, even to this day, one of our top political cartoonists in New Zealand.
But everybody remembers that.
Everyone remembers that. But,
that
but,
incident.
Yeah. But, yeah, you know, he didn't get jailed. He
didn't
get
tortured.
And actually, you know, I think Muldoon would have happily silenced him if he could, but he couldn't. There was no mechanism for him to do it. We have to defend that. We have to work quite hard to make sure that we don't drift into a situation and where we feel that it's acceptable to silence criticism.
As well.
Yeah, I think people are quite complacent at the moment about that question. And part of the problem, I think, is that we are engaged in a lot of arguments about what is acceptable speech, what is helpful speech, what is harmful speech.
Mm.
And, you know, I have a lot of friends on the left who are talking about people shouldn't be saying this and this person should be fired because they said this, or they should be. And I've had, during the Charlie Hebdo, the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo shootings, you know, left-wing progressive cartoonists even, who were saying Charlie Hebdo should have been banned. I feel like we can't give in to the temptation to decide that
it's because, do you think it's because people don't want to offend other people? And it's got to the point where offensive behaviour is still offensive behaviour, and sometimes you have to. It's like the elephant in the room. It has to be said. Who are we offending and why? And is that offensive?
Yeah, I find all kinds of things really offensive.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
We have some very prominent broadcasters in New Zealand who are regularly awfully racist.
The talkback is just full
Totally.
Horrible attitudes.
And we have, I mean, among our most popular broadcasters at the moment are Mike Hosking and Paul Henry, and they play the whole Jeremy Clarkson game. You know, their whole shtick is to be sort of anti-PC and it's very tiresome. It drives me crazy. It's
really allows, for me, it permits casualisation of racism or of discriminatory behaviour and bigotry.
Yeah,
but they kind of give that permission.
And I think the concern is, as you say, that it gives people permission. It's and the thing that everyone always says when they're criticised is, oh, they're just saying what everyone thinks. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, but
I don't think that.
You know, I really don't think that.
I'm not everyone, but I don't think like that.
Yeah. Mm. So because you've got all of that going on, it's really tempting to kind of to start falling to the trap of saying, well, people shouldn't be allowed to say this stuff on air. And people who do say it, we should be able to prosecute them because it's normalizing racism, it's normalizing hate speech, all of that kind of thing. But what we do then is we say, well, so it's okay to suppress some speech, censor some speech, and to suppress it even to the point of prosecuting people and potentially putting them in jail. And really what it comes down to is we just need to decide which speech we prosecute. Now, once we accept that idea, once we accept that some speech can be prosecuted and that people can be jailed for it, then we give governments and police the power to decide which speech, because we don't get to decide that. We actually, we might think that right now we do because we're the ones creating the Twitter storms or whatever, but actually, you know, if you allow the law to arrest people for certain, you know, certain political expressions and things, then you actually give that power to people who aren't necessarily going to be on your side all the time.
They're not going to be thinking the same way you are, but it's
no.
The trajectory, it could be that that's where it falls.
Yes.
And this is the dangerous, I believe, probably one of the most dangerous eras that we are experiencing at the moment.
Yeah, if we decide that some cartoonists are drawing pictures that are just too offensive and they're too unhelpful on issues like racism and so on. And those cartoonists should be banned. Or there was a prominent New Zealand broadcaster who I have a lot of respect for what he's achieved over the years, which is Derek Fox. He helped set up, he set up Mana magazine. He ran Māori TV for a while. He's a very important guy in broadcasting. But he went on Facebook and basically said the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists were asking for it. It's their fault.
Oh, that's disappointing.
It was extremely disappointing. And, you know, he had a point about punching down, satirists punching down, and so on, which I get very tired of hearing that. But thought that to hear that from someone who's a journalist, I thought was incredibly disappointing, because who gets to decide that it's okay to shoot a journalist or cartoonist? Who gets to make that decision? And once you accept that it's okay in certain situations to shoot people because they've written or drawn things that you don't like, then I'm sorry, but you're opening the door to, and in the end it becomes, in the case of censorship, they have the most power or the most money or the most political influence. Well, that's not the people that we're trying to protect when people on the left argue in favour of censorship. We're doing it because we're trying to protect the powerless from the powerful. Well, you don't do that by giving more tools to the powerful to suppress speech, because they're going to be used against the powerless. That's what's going to happen. And it's happened over and over again in history.
I mean, for me, it's sort of like it's opening doors to some behaviour that more people will, you know, more people will suffer because of it. And especially when it comes to freedom of expression and art and those sorts of things. I mean, it's not a pleasant future at all for anyone. It doesn't matter what your background. This will not be a pleasant future.
And also, I also feel like, you know, I would actually, I want to know what people are thinking. I actually want to hear it. I want to see the offensive drawings, and I want to try and understand what's going on. And I want to respond to them, and I want to argue with them and criticise them. But I want to see them, and I want to hear those views. Because how on earth can we understand where people are coming from if we don't hear them? You know, I would rather that we can hear the Islamic State propaganda. I'd rather that that's accessible. If you want to try and understand what the hell is going on with those, because no one understands what that's about in the West. We don't get it. Well, some people do, because they're rushing off to fight for Islamic State.
Yes.
We need to understand why people are doing that. You know, and we're not going to understand that if we just suppress everything.
Well, what gets me is to find out why people are donating huge sums of money as well. It's like from all backgrounds. And they are very savvy. That's the only word I can think of. Savvy with their social media. I know it sounds wrong, but they know exactly how to use the social media to appeal to, I guess, to some people. But when I see queer people and LGBTIQ people being stoned to death, it just horrifies me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we can't, you know, I think when people
it's so glossy the way they're doing it. It's so glossy and professionally done. It really, really concerns me.
Yeah, and it's horrifying. It's horrifying what's happening over there for feminists, for women who want to, who actually want to have more equality. It's horrifying what's happening for LGBT people. It's just awful. I've seen those same pictures. And those same.
You've got to turn it off.
No. But it's not just Islamic State. You know, it's plenty of actual states too. It's plenty of governments that are doing that.
And it puts
Western liberals in a really difficult place, because we're so used to trying to not impose what we see is, you know, we don't want to sort of do some kind of neo-imperialistic imposition of Western values and so on. But you know what? There are queer people being murdered in large numbers. And the ones who aren't being murdered are living in fear of being murdered. And that's really not okay. I'm not actually prepared to accept that that's okay.
And then, of course, they have to prove that they are being persecuted and that they are being hurt and life is at threat. And then, of course, they can be sent back to those countries, and that's there's not much protection.
Yeah, the whole refugee thing is a whole.
Yes, I know the big R word. Other big R word.
We've wandered far from comics.
We have, but it is Anzac Day.
Kind of haven't, because actually one of the things I've been really impressed by in the Australian comic scene in the last few years is the way cartoonists here have really stepped up to give a voice to refugees and to raise to draw attention to the reality of what's happening to asylum seekers here and in the Australian camps offshore. And I've been amazed by the cartoonists doing fantastic work on that and people involved in the Refugee Art Project. Maybe it's just because I'm following the comics thing, but it seems to me as though some of the strongest expressions of what's happening and the strongest revelations of what's happening have actually come through comics. It's been amazing.
Yeah, no, comics is a great, powerful weapon in this case and voice and tool. A skill that is incredible, and certainly Dylan, you're one of those people. You are. You know, I mean, you're very humble.
just anxious. But I feel like the refugee issue in Australia has there's very little for Australian politics to be proud of in how that's gone in the last decade or two.
It's been going on for a long time.
But I do think there's quite a lot to be proud of about the way way Australian cartoonists have responded. I actually think this is a good moment for Australian cartoonists to feel proud of the way people have stepped up on that issue. Because God knows there's so few people actually taking a stand.
Well, the major mainstream media doesn't. So, and it's been the same for the shutting down of Aboriginal and Indigenous and Torres Strait Island communities.
Yes.
The artists that have stepped up there as well, and the smaller community media has been amazing.
Mm. And that's, it's a reminder of what we can do.
Mm.
That,
and we cannot have that taken away.
No. Every so often, there's a situation where it's the artists, and often, it's like the small press artists and the alternative artists, they step up and they actually give a voice to people who are in terrible situations. They speak out against terrible things that are being done, and that's so important and so precious. And, I'm not prepared to sacrifice that as a right that artists have. I think it's so important. And I really think that's that right now in Australia, that's what's happening. I think that the art world in Australia at the moment is leading the opposition to a lot of terrible things that are happening. I wish I could say the same about New Zealand. New Zealand's politics is so messy and complicated and depressing at the moment, but
it's just a different scale, I think, a different cultural history. There's always something going on there that's that's not right, but there's voices of opinion against it, of course, but it's a different scale, I guess.
Well, I think that right now in Australia, I mean, here I am coming over from New Zealand telling you what but I do feel as though, viewing it from New Zealand, it feels as though right now there are some really clear moral issues that are they feel very sharply drawn. I mean, the things that are happening at the moment with refugees and with Indigenous people, and I feel like it's so clear, and it's so clear that there are things being done that are utterly dreadful. They shouldn't be being done, and there's so little opposition to it. So little opposition that the political parties sometimes seem to be competing to be even more terrible because they
get the same votes and
they feel like it's going to work go well with the electorate and with a few very noble exceptions and also on environmental issues which are so scary at the moment. But like I said, I think I've been really really impressed with the way artists, cartoonists, writers in Australia have actually stepped up, and they're filling that gap that really politicians should be
And it's a very positive in the comics community too, with the rise or more females, more women getting involved in comics as well. And in the future, I'm sure we'll see more satire coming from that aspect particularly. Again, it's one of the big three things that have been happening in Australia, the refugee issue and, of course, the Indigenous issue. It's always there as something that is hard, a stumbling block for Australian progress, I think, progress. And, of course, the more recent times, definitely the build-up of hatred towards women in Australia. I don't know if you're aware of it, but 31 women have been murdered just in this year alone. And those are just facts. And
luckily, you've got a great minister for women to
to address. Oh dear! No.
I think one of the positive developments in New Zealand comics in the last few years too has also been a growth in the diversity of people making comics, and we have an anthology of comics by New Zealand women which is coming out soon called Three Words. And that's kind of brought to light a lot of great work that was not really being seen or paid much attention to. We have a very interesting cartoonist who's actually coming to Australia soon for the, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's the Festival for Upcoming Writers, New Voices. And his name's Sam Orchard, and he's...
Sam, yeah, awesome, yes.
Yeah, he's a very interesting cartoonist too.
He's coming over here in June too, I think.
Yeah. June, right, that'll be it. And so he's coming over, and he does a web comic, which documents his own experiences as a young trans man.
Is this Rooster Tales?
Tales. That's it, yeah. And he's got a very interesting comics series out. He's published a series of comics called Family Portraits. And it's a collection of stories told by queer New Zealanders about their own personal histories and stories and experiences. And it's a wonderful collection of... because he brings together a whole lot of voices. But he also explores his own story.
Yeah, he's a very influential person, I believe. He's probably one of the... yeah, very influential. Very good.
Yeah, and he does a lot of really interesting work in New Zealand outside of comics too. You know, he's been an activist. He's been working in Rainbow Youth, which is an LGBT organisation for young people to get in touch with. And, you know, he just does a lot of... he's a really fabulous guy. he's one of our treasures.
Yeah.
One of our taonga in New Zealand comics. And actually right now, in political cartooning in New Zealand, one of our most interesting cartoonists now is Sharon Murdoch, who has been doing cartooning for a long time, but she's only recently got a regular gig in the newspaper.
Cool.
And she's just been nominated for the top cartooning award in New Zealand. She's very quickly suddenly become, you know, one of our absolute top cartoonists. She's doing work that leaves a lot of the older guys in the dust. So it's a really interesting time, and things are changing quickly. And the other big change in New Zealand, which is quite a little more prosaic, a little more practical, is that we're starting to get an infrastructure for comics. We now have three publishers who specialise in comics and graphic novels, including Picatia Press, Matt Emery's one, but also Square Planet, which publishes a number of things, including Blastosaurus, and one called Earth's End Publishing, who recently collected Ant Sang's graphic novel Dharma Punks, which is a real landmark in New Zealand, New Zealand comics. And there's also a magazine called Faction Comics, which has been going.
Yes, I've seen that.
And they've got a new issue out, which is a little hardcover book called High Water.
Is that the global warming one?
Yeah, it's about...
they were on TV.
They were on TV. they've been getting great publicity. That I went to the launch of that book. It's a collection of New Zealand of comics by New Zealanders about climate change, or inspired by the issue. And I was at the launch of that, and it was the co-leader of the Green Party was one of the speakers, and you know, it was a
goodness,
big TV event. It was really something.
That's cool.
So, and actually, that, you know, that was an example of a way in which New Zealand cartoonists and artists in general are stepping up on issues, because High Water is also the name of an organisation that's been set up for artists of all kinds to raise the issue of climate change.
Yeah, well, it's a big issue for New Zealand.
Yeah.
High Water.
Well, exactly. You know,
Australia's more like burnt to a cinder, yeah, quite frankly.
Yeah, and the odd flood here and there too.
Yes,
I mean,
flood.
In New Zealand, you're never very far from the beach. So
it'll get closer to you in the future.
Exactly, and it's just getting closer and closer. In fact, where I live very near the beach, and mm-hmm, and the erosion in the last 10 years is much quicker than it used to be.
Yeah, it's faster than they actually estimated it to begin with, just purely scientifically. Mm. So anyone who denies that is no comment. No comment.
Yeah. Yes, and yeah, sometimes you just have to look at their motives as well.
Yeah, I know. That is very disappointing.
Yeah. Mm. But wow. Yeah, I bet it's a. But despite all the doom and gloom.
Yes, despite all that.
For comics, it's an incredibly exciting time.
Mm.
And I think that comics are more diverse, more exploring more topics. They're much more becoming a central part of the cultural landscape. I don't think there's ever been a better time.
Accessibility helps, you know, yeah, technology. You can download, you can publish yourself,
yeah,
online in any case, and just the community word getting out there and people getting together in gatherings like the Home Cooked one today, yeah, Home Cooked Comics Festival, is an example of many things that are happening, I would say, hopefully globally. But I'm sure there are regions where they're dying to make comments, literally.
Well, one of the interesting things is at Angoulême, I met a very interesting cartoonist from India who's done a couple of beautiful graphic novels, Amruta Patil. There's quite an interesting comic scene emerging in India.
Wow.
And also Egypt. There have been some interesting comics coming out of Egypt. China has a growing kind of alternative comic scene.
Mm.
Some of which they have trouble getting published in China, but they're getting published in Europe and other places.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they've also got a growing comic scene there, which is more, it's easier to get published, which is more kind of manga influenced and is just more adventure stories. Mm. But the alternative stuff's very, very interesting. And Africa has a growing comics scene in various countries. And in fact, there was a comic published a couple of years ago that looks very interesting from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Mm.
Which was exploring the history of the country there, which is not an altogether happy history in recent times.
Mm.
But it was covering the history since independence. And in Lebanon, there's a number of very interesting cartoonists emerged out of Lebanon in recent years.
Mm.
You know, it's just an extraordinary time for comics. And we can find this stuff now because of the internet.
I know.
Yeah.
Wonderful thing.
Mm.
About such a, you can explore and find people that you may think you've got nothing in common with, but you've got a comic aesthetic in common with, or something expresses it so succinctly and so fairly quickly in a cartoon, and more accessible than the written page. Nothing wrong with the written page, of course, books are wonderful, but
words are fine, we like words.
That's not so easy to get hold of sometimes.
Yeah, so I feel like the days when I started doing comics, comics were still seen very much as a kind of a just a nerdy fringe thing that was dominated by spotty boys who wanted superhero comics, and you'd go to the comic shop, and if you saw a girl, it was kind of a shock, and so it was a very different landscape, and it was dominated by America, certainly in New Zealand, it was dominated by America and Britain. And the imported comics, and that was it. And boy, has the world changed. Mm.
It's not Beano and Superboy anymore, or Superman anymore.
No, I mean, those days are just, they're just gone. Yeah. And thank heavens, you know, it's a really, I just feel like this is a new golden age for comics.
Mm. You're certainly part of it. Thank you. I'm going to end it here because we have been talking a lot for this special podcast, which is awesome. I'm happy to do that. And it's great to talk to a icon of comics here and back over the ditch in New Zealand, Dylan Horrocks. Thank you so much for speaking to us on Sci-Fi and Squeam.
Thank you.
I'm Dylan Horrocks. Well, you're Dylan Horrocks, obviously. It's identification issues, but and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. Is that okay?
So, Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy FM 99?
No, FM, 94.9.
94.9. Joy, 94.9. Mm. Okay, cool. I'll try. It might take me a couple of goes. I'm Dylan Horrocks, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
That's it.
Yeah.
Just say 94.9 again. That's fine.
On Joy 94.9.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much.
It's a comic. It's not a comic. It's a zine.
It's not a zine.
It's Joy Zine.
What is it?
Joy Zine.
It's going to be
an amazing thing. What's it about?
Find out soon.
More details will be released for Sci-Fi and Squeam
on Joy 94.9.
It's a handmade DIY zine with comics, cartoons, artists, creators,
poets.
It has writings.
It's a queer zine. It's a queer zine.
And you,
yes, you
can be involved.
Just
stay tuned to Sci-Fi and Squeam
on Joy 94.9.
Just go to joy.org.au
or Sci-Fi and Squeam Facebook page.
Joy Zine.
Hello Kitty is a girl, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycasts
and show blogs.
Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.